Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, where our mission is to make visionary community improvement the norm in this sector's work rather than the exception. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about this sector's potential for creating visionary social change. It is my pleasure to have Albert Rezga as my guest today on Making Change. Albert has been president and CEO of the Greater New Orleans Foundation since January of 2009. Reading Albert's resume prior to his move to New Orleans, though, feels like looking at a cross-section of all the many ways one can work in the social change arena. Albert has worked inside several foundations and now serves on the boards of both Grantmakers for Effective Organizations, GEO, and Hispanics in Philanthropy. He was the founding director of New Ventures in Philanthropy, a national initiative that has helped generate more than $500 million in new philanthropic resources. And in his off hours, Albert founded and still writes for White Courtesy Telephone, a provocative and sometimes downright controversial blog about the world of philanthropy. The thread running through all of Albert's work has been a deep commitment to social change and particularly social justice, a commitment Albert continues through his work with the Aspen Philanthropy Group, the Ford Foundation Working Group for Peace and Social Justice Philanthropy, and the Southern Social Justice Working Group. With the range of experience and dedication to social justice that is so evident in Albert's decades in the social change arena, and in honor of the 6th anniversary of the devastation New Orleans experienced in the face of Hurricane Katrina at just about this time in 2005, it is my pleasure to have Albert Rezga share his observations with us today here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Albert Rezga. Albert, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here with us. The question that I start all of my interviews with, I would love to know, given the variety of your background, the observations that you have over time, when you see change happening in communities, what are some of the factors that you see that are undergirding that change and making it possible?
Well, pretty much all cases, strong leadership, and I guess that's one of philanthropy's dirty little secrets that, you kind of have your checklist of the effectiveness of an organization and its finances and all of these other things, but often you're making an assessment of how strong the leader is, how strong the person is who's sitting across the table from you and whether he or she is going to be able to marshal other resources. Doing with rather than doing to, or efforts that focus on structure or on underlying causes, not ignoring culture and cultural factors. And I'm thinking about a colleague of mine who put it very well, who said that culture can so easily kill strategy. And I think that's absolutely true. Efforts that cross sectoral and institutional boundaries, a long time frame, so that you're not thinking in terms of 2 or 3 years, you're thinking in terms of a generation.
Mm-hmm.
And really, what so many people have been talking about, holding yourself accountable for the kind of change that you're committing to making.
Well, we've got about 17 hours of stuff to talk about.
Oh, great.
What a wonderful list.
Let's do parts 1 through 9, I suppose.
We'll just turn this into a year worth of interviews. I love it. To me, the highest of all of the pieces that you said were holding ourselves accountable. And that, I think, goes hand in hand with strong leadership, because I'm looking at the list of everything that you named, and it seems that those are all pieces of how we hold ourselves accountable. Paying attention to cultural factors and looking at underlying causes, doing with versus doing to. But let's start at the beginning. Let's start with the whole sense of holding ourselves accountable and being strong leaders. What does that look like?
Well, here's the thing. I think any reasonably intelligent person, if you put several million dollars in his or her hands, they're going to be able to create some kind of social change.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really creating social change per se, but what's the character of that social change? And when you hold yourself accountable, you don't just rattle off the fact that, let's say, you housed 9,500 people or that so many people were fed, but that the earth shifted in some way for the communities that you're trying to serve. That at the end of the day, if you're trying to reduce inequities, it's palpable. The change that you've made in a community as far as inequities goes is palpable. And it's not just that you've helped a few families, although those are wonderful things. But holding yourself accountable is really saying that, look, if by the end of 2, 3, 5, 10 years, whatever your tenure is, you haven't done what you said you were going to do, that you fire yourself. You don't wait for your board to fire you. And of course, that means being clear about how you measure that kind of change. For me, the most compelling way to measure it is simply to see it.
Right.
And I've been fortunate enough to work in contexts where you've been able to see the change over time, where it's not something that's dubious given the statistical or the data or the statistics on the data that are available to you. Just see it.
Can you give us an example?
Oh, sure, yeah. Not here at the foundation I work at now, but at a previous foundation I worked with a very seasoned program officer. She'd been in the business for about 20 years. Mm-hmm. And she and her colleagues, because she had a lot of co-conspirators in this, decided that they were really going to shift how low-income people were able to access health care. And this is in the District of Columbia. I can give that away.
Okay.
And what she did was, you know, what was striking about what she did was she had a very, very long timeline in view. She was fearless about bringing together a whole array of people who would have a stake in this. She was very strategic about building the capacity of institutions that might be able to deliver this change. She didn't let small setbacks stop her. And she had enough time to work in partnership with others to make this change happen. Mm-hmm. And what she was able, with her colleagues, to accomplish was to gain access to primary health care for every man, woman, and child in the District of Columbia, for every adult up to 200% of the federal poverty level, and for every child up to 300% of the federal poverty level.
Wow.
And that's palpable change. And then, you know, the next piece of that was to start putting a medical home within a walking distance or within every neighborhood in the District of Columbia. Now, you know, that's change that you see, that you could touch, that you could feel.
Yeah.
And it's also one that would, given how important health issues are to other aspects of our being, our financial health,
right,
our ability to function in a job, it's going to have enormous repercussions for years to come.
How long did that take?
I think it was over a period of 15 years, 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
And that's this issue about having a long time frame. So all of those elements were there. There was that strong leadership. There was the doing with. There was the focus on structure, underlying causes, a need to change a pervasive culture, and certainly crossing the kind of sectoral and these institutional boundaries, because there were primary care providers, there were activists, there were consumers who were involved, there were funders, people from the city. So it was really a stunning, in my view, a really stunning piece of work.
And this was instigated by a foundation, by a funder?
Well, not just by one foundation, but by at least, I'd say there were two main co-conspirators. They were funders, but certainly without the partnership with these other sectors and with these other individuals, I don't think it would have been possible. And they knew that, and that was the other. That's what made the work so brilliant.
The interesting things that we find when it comes to that long-term thinking, when we give ourselves permission to think about that big picture outcome that we want and give ourselves permission to say it may take longer than the 1 to 2 year grant cycle that we're so used to kowtowing to, it's a lot easier when you're the funder than when you are the organization thinking against those kinds of frequently self-imposed limits. What do you see going on in organizations that are not funders that are feeling so hamstrung?
Oh, we've put them in such an awful position. I mean, think about it. There's a lot of calls for social entrepreneurship and nonprofit organizations. They should be pulling themselves up by their own bootstraps, and they should stop thinking in terms of, you know, nonprofit and for-profit, and we should, you know, blur the sectors. And in some ways, that's true for a lot of organizations. But I think really there are quite a large number of organizations that do work that nobody really wants to pay for. I mean, it's hard work. Nobody really wants to help, except foundations, wants to help prisoners reintegrate into the neighborhood. That's just such an unpopular cause with individual donors.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody really wants to pay for health care for the indigent. Nobody really wants to work on immigrant issues. These are issues that are very unpopular with a lot of donors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we put nonprofit organizations in a kind of perpetual paper chase. The work that they do is essential to social cohesion. It's essential to keeping us together as a society. And yet they are in a constant scramble for funding. They are up against enormous odds in being able to accomplish what they set out to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very seldom, and of course they don't have endowments or sugar daddies or sugar mommies.
Right.
So they're really in a tough spot. And at the same time, you know, a lot of funders are telling them, you know, you should be doing more with less. I just don't see how that's going to happen.
Yeah.
We as a society need to just acknowledge that there are some nonprofits that will always be struggling because we've set them up to fail. The capital markets for nonprofits are abysmal. They have a product that nobody really wants to buy.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the Pollyanna principles in my book, there's 6 principles that we've found going on that happen when social change is happening. And the last of them is that individuals will go where systems lead them. We keep blaming organizations for things that they really don't have a whole lot of control over, that they are the very tip of the tail at the end of a very large dog. And there's an interesting story Joel Oros had told me. Joel was with Kellogg for a long time, the Kellogg Foundation, and was part of...
I know him well. He's wonderful.
Isn't he just darling? Part of the founding of the Dorothy Johnson Center in Grand Rapids. And Joel tells a story that if funders funded a child from the age of 0 to walk, and they did the typical one-year grant, at the end of that 1 year, they would assume that that grant was an abysmal failure. And that it wouldn't matter that at age 15, this kid is running marathons and winning marathons, but that's how we look at things. So it really has been an interesting journey to find, how do we look at those systems then that are, and I love the way you put it, essential to social cohesion? What are ways that change that cultural mindset that maybe bring that more into the fore?
Well, Hildy, I think the work that you're doing with the kinds of interviews that you're doing are getting at some of these aspects of our work that we so seldom talk about, that really are what make or break our work. And I think there's a sense perhaps in the field that these aspects may be a little soft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not like hard evaluation. They're, bromides. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You hear people say different things. But really, my experience has been that the way I heard someone put it once, is that they're typically more problems and opportunities around the table than there are on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And that means we have to work on what are sense of our limitations are, the kinds of analyses that we jump to when we try to, when we approach a social problem or a social opportunity. And we tend to focus on the technocratic side of grant making, and we ignore the other sides or the other aspects of grant making to our peril.
So it brings about the question, tell me a little bit about what the Greater New Orleans Foundation is doing that addresses some of that. Are you guys bringing more stuff onto the table? You're in an area where it is overwhelming to think about all of the different things that would not only not be on the table, but might be falling off the table. Tell us a little bit about what's going on with what you're doing.
Yeah, sure. It's so hard to talk about the work of any one community foundation unless you really get deep into the context. But, you know, as I look at the context in which we work here in New Orleans, we have an abiding and pervasive racism that is at work in other communities. And its effects are felt and seen everywhere, and yet we don't talk about it in those terms. And we suffer here from some of the same, I would say, underlying causes or underlying factors that other people in other places suffer from, the kind of anti-intellectualism, anti-enlightenmentism, if you want to call it that. We suffer from the wealth gap and the fact that the middle class is losing ground. We suffer from some of the effects of globalism, American consumerism, from the fact that there's so much money in politics. You can go on down the list. But these are largely structural and moral issues. And what we see, what you experience when you're in New Orleans, which is a city that I think we need to give a break to. I mean, it's been 5 years since this horrible disaster happened, and there have been a few other disasters since then. But that in that time has made enormous strides. And what we worry most about at the Community Foundation is not letting ourselves, once we've rebuilt, kind of sink back into the ooze. And for us, sinking back into the ooze means sinking back into kind of business as usual and taking for granted that some of the deep inequities that we see in our region are just a matter of course and that they can't be addressed, that there's just no possible way we can address them because these problems are too large. And I think that's what we're trying to, in our own way and over time, and in a way that really brings other people to the table, that's what we're trying to put on the table. The fact that it's not good enough to rebuild as good as before, but that there are things that we need to name and things that we need to address over time that we haven't been willing to name and address.
Is that discussion starting to happen, and what is the response to that?
Yes, it is. And I think that it's slow. And I think that from my perspective, I've been here for 3 years. We're about 6 years out from the storms from the storms of 2005. We're going to celebrate the sixth anniversary of Katrina on the 29th. There was a real opening. There was a real shaking up of things at every single level you can imagine by the storms. And this I get, obviously, from having spoken to hundreds of people who were here during the storms before and after. And there was a real opening, and you've seen the benefits of that, higher levels of civic engagement, measurably higher levels of civic engagement, in some cases, on some measures, off the charts, in terms of people who want to participate, let's say, in community meetings or are willing to attend a city council meeting, those kinds of things. A real willingness to kind of take responsibility for your neighbors and your neighborhood has been an incredible gift of the storms. We also have, for the first time in a long time, a lot of hope about public education because, you know, Louisiana was at the bottom of the bottom, state-wise, and then New Orleans was at the bottom of cities in Louisiana, so you couldn't go much further down. But there's been an incredible leaders in public education reform here who have been making measurable difference in the lives of our low-income kids.
I'm curious what has allowed that to happen. What has suddenly turned that needle for public education?
Well, there's actually quite a bit of controversy about that. But after the storms, when everything was in pieces on the ground, there was special legislation passed at the state level to strengthen an entity called the Recovery School District that was empowered to take over failing schools in Louisiana, and that essentially took over these failing schools, dissolved the teachers' union, hired back good teachers, and then took it from there. And we have one of the, what I would say, probably the most exciting experiment in charter school education here in New Orleans. We have about 70% of our kids in charter schools now, and that number is going to grow. And whereas charter schools in other parts of the country have been performing pretty well, not really demonstrating that they can do much better than other kinds of public schools, in New Orleans, they've been making incredible strides, measurable strides with our kids. And I think it was the storms opened up that window. And again, without controversy, because obviously when you're firing a lot of teachers, you're going to generate enormous controversy. And then the storm, I think, has opened, and I've heard this from a lot of people who've been here for quite a while, opened people's minds to looking outside of New Orleans for models and for ideas. And there has been, I think, that great opening, at least from the account of a lot of people. And I'm not a sociologist. I don't want to practice kind of armchair sociology. But my sense is, you know, the consensus seems to be is that New Orleans before the storms was not quite that open to these new ideas.
It's interesting. I've had many conversations with the folks in Christchurch who have suffered devastating earthquakes over the past year. And the number of aftershocks that they've had is unfathomable, that you really never know within a day how many times the earth is going to shake under your feet. And they invited me to Skype in and YouTube in to a conference that they were doing that was rooted in the fact that the earthquakes, while horrifying and devastating, just as the storms were in New Orleans, also brought out the best in people. Also brought out that sense of possibility, that sense of starting over, that sense of we really have each other. And what their question was that this conference was about was, how do we keep that alive? How do we continue this sense of some of the things that they found were leadership was emerging from surprising places. So people were not like you're talking about, taking responsibility for each other is just what they were finding.
Yeah.
That whole issue of civic engagement. And so the question really then becomes, how do you keep that spirit that what they found is something that was there all along that was just not being tapped? How do we keep that alive?
You know, that's a great question. It's funny that I think that spirit persists longer, fortunately, than media interest does, right?
Yeah.
Because we know the media window closes after about 2 weeks.
I was going to say, anything persists longer than the media interest does.
Yes. Well, here's what happened. I mean, I try to imagine it because, of course, I was at a very safe distance from it all. But, you know, so 80% of your city is underwater. And this is coming to a place that was already suffering from blight, a place that had already deep inequities, that had, you know, the bottom of the bottom in the schools. And then there was, by many accounts, a dysfunctional municipal government that was about to erase neighborhoods, turn them into essentially green spaces, flood them. And from what I hear, it's like every other person was starting a nonprofit or, you know, not formally incorporating one, but really taking responsibility. And these organizations, these individuals who were kind of forged in that crucible are still around today. They're still very much engaged. And once you create an opportunity for leadership and you forge new leaders, it's not as if they just kind of lose their ability to be leaders once the crisis is over. And we continue, I think, to benefit from their leadership. It's just extraordinary. Now, how do you nurture that? I wish I knew the best answers. Obviously, you try to put resources into their hands. You try to connect them with other people who are like-minded. You try to show them, give them an opportunity to see models in other places, to have that kind of expansion of the space of possibilities in their own minds continue after the crisis is gone. And we do all of those things, or we try to do all of those things through our grant making.
I wish we had more time, because truly, the things that you've brought up, I would love to spend months just talking about. But it really comes back to the things that we started. It's interesting to me. I wrote down all the things when I asked you initially, what do you see underpinning change? Strong leadership was the first thing you said, and holding ourselves accountable was the last thing that you said. The interesting thing to those bookends for me is that the leadership, the engagement, the desire to create something strong was in New Orleans and in Christchurch and in areas that have seen devastation way before there was the devastation. And what has happened is the storm, the earthquake, the catastrophe has given the opportunity, has opened up that crack so that that could come out. And I guess the question that I will sort of end with, and we can keep talking about just a little bit, the last question I'd like to ask is, how do we then focus on, if what it is leadership, if what these catastrophes has brought forward is really that innate leadership in people that we never thought were leaders before, how do we nurture that? How do we bring out a sense of strong leadership where folks learn how to hold themselves accountable outside of needing something catastrophic to happen?
I don't think it's leadership training programs. Right. When I was working at the Meyer Foundation, we worked with, I think it was GEO, to do a scan of the literature on the connection between leadership training programs and the effectiveness of nonprofit organizations or civil society organizations, let's call them that, to see what the literature said about that. Was there any data to support that connection? And surprisingly, despite the very large number of these kinds of programs, there was very, very little to substantiate the claim that strengthening leadership, and by the way, interpreted in many different ways,
of course.
There's very little to substantiate the claim that simply by strengthening leadership, you would necessarily have better outcomes for an organization as measured by, you know, a number of different kinds of proxies. So in some ways, it's an article of faith. In other ways, not, because we see it, we experience it in our lives, in our everyday lives. And by starting with leadership, I don't mean to say that, you know, that's kind of sufficient.
Mm-mm.
Certainly necessary, I would think, but not sufficient. And I think that there are quite a number of factors we haven't discussed that are probably equally important. Right now in New Orleans, I think what has a potential to keep us from becoming what I would say is a world-class city, a city that is really the kind of model that many of us think about when we envision what the ideal is really the things that we don't face, whether we have strong leadership or not. It's the really tough stuff, the racism, the isms, the fact that we as a society more generally have not addressed some of these issues, and that in some cases we really don't know how, in many cases, how to address some of these issues. And I wish I could assign a weight to leadership and say it's, you know, 80% of the game, but I can't. Because, again, it's so context-specific. It's so time-specific, place- and time-specific. There really is a need to learn to find what's emerging from a group of people who are in leadership positions, and to how do you help that energy develop and bring about change? And all of these are very tough questions. I think a lot of instinct is involved, using your experience, but I'm very skeptical about some of the approaches that we've had to nurturing and developing leaders, I have to say.
It's interesting that we look at leadership in such different ways, that leadership training programs, as you mentioned, the study that GEO had done, really focuses on sort of top-down organizational leadership.
Yes.
And what you're really talking about is emerging leadership, acknowledging untapped leadership in the community, which is a whole piece of that doing with versus doing to that you were talking about before. The whole issue of crossing sectors and crossing institutions. Sometime, heaven forbid, we should actually cross the street into our communities and look at what is really going on with the people to whom we are doing rather than with whom. So I think
I think that
some of the answers are really sitting there waiting for us to find them.
Yeah. I wish we more often asked the people that we were aiming to serve how well we did. So how did we do on, reducing inequities? Well, you know, not so hot.
Well, one of the things that I'm glad we had a chance to do was one of the things that you mentioned is that we don't take enough time to just talk about these things, that we assume that they're soft. We assume that because they're, quote, soft, that they're not important, and that they really are the underlying things that are probably more important than anything else. So I really thank you for taking time out of your day, Albert, to talk with us, and hopefully we will be able to do this again soon.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
My interview with Albert comes at a time when the world is remembering several anniversaries of recent devastation. In the span of just a few short weeks, we're witnessing the 6th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, and the one-year anniversary of the first of several powerful earthquakes that have all but demolished the city center in Christchurch, New Zealand. In each of these horrible disasters, we've seen evidence of the best of our humanity, a spirit of generosity and cohesion, dramatic increases in civic engagement, community members who'd never been seen as leaders suddenly showing their leadership abilities. The interesting thing about such times is that by showing what's possible when people are under unimaginable stress, we're showing what's even more possible when we're not under such stress. Albert's stories and observations make that clear. When the foundations in Washington, D.C. set out to ensure that every single person living in the district had health care, they accomplished it. What's interesting, though, is that when Albert talks about the conditions that must be present for change to happen, the focus on structural change, the need to work with each other, the need to be attentive to culture, the need for everyone to work together across boundaries, these are the same qualities we see arising in communities that have experienced devastating catastrophes. We also see leadership arising where we least expect it, leadership that helps, as Albert noted, develop the energy that is emerging from the people themselves, leadership that arises from the community and holds itself accountable for tackling the things we as a society may not want to talk about. The last thing that struck me as Albert was sharing his observations is the extent to which he spoke of measurement, not by gathering data, but by asking the obvious questions. Has the earth shifted? Is there visible, palpable change that we can quite simply just see? While the sector's standard bearers may continue to emphasize the need for strong leadership at the top, measurement that can be quantified, and attention to financial viability, the reality of what creates change may just be the things that become so clear when a community faces the loss that we're memorializing this month. Which leads to questions for your own work. Are you taking time in your organization to talk about the indicators you might notice to determine whether you're creating change that is palpable? Do you have a structure in place for identifying leaders that may be hiding in plain sight in your community or within your organization? Are you working to understand how culture affects the decisions and actions of the people in your community
and the people you find within your own organization? And lastly, what are you holding yourself accountable for accomplishing? And what visible, palpable signs will you look for to know if you're achieving that? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you'll share your observations at the Chronicle's website, philanthropy.com, or at the Chronicle's Making Change group at LinkedIn. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you the second Thursday of next month here on Making Change.